This is an ABC podcast.
This is Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia.
Hello and welcome to Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Wendy Mockey. A lot of us grow up in two worlds. One, a village in Papua New Guinea, where the mountains watch over you, the languages are ancient, and your aunties move through the world like they invented time. The other, a city in so-called Australia, where you're told who you are by people who have never seen your country on a map. That's the kind of in-between Elvina Pocky Ogle knows well. She's a corporate lawyer, a podcast host, and someone who isn't afraid to name the things others won't. Colonial hangovers, systemic inequality, or the quiet ways culture disappears when no one is paying attention. But ask her how she identifies, and she'll say, I'm a member of my father's tribe first and foremost. I'm Wendy Mockey. This is Stories from the Pacific, and I'd like to welcome a dear sister of mine, Elvina Ogle.
Thank you so much, Wendy. It's great to be here.
You hail from the Western Highlands province of Papua New Guinea and were raised in mostly in Australia, but yet your identity is deeply grounded in your Tokples, your tribe, and the time you spent back in the village being raised by your grandparents, your aunties, and a community living a way of life that has already started disappearing. Now, let's begin there. Can you tell me about the time when your parents sent you back to PNG as a child? What do you remember most about arriving in the village?
Well, my parents took me back after raising me outside of the village. I was born in Monhagen, but they lived in Australia and a few other countries. And they, when I was about 5 or 6, they took me back to the village because my dad had plans to plant coffee or grow coffee. He was a bit of a hustler, so he wanted to explore that sort of part of his life. And they took me back. They had a home. They still do have a lovely home in the village. And they took me back and I spoke English was my first language, so I didn't speak any Tokples at all. I don't think I spoke Tokples in, but they just let me run wild in the village following my grandmother. And there started really the greatest years of my childhood. It wasn't that long, actually, probably a year and a bit or year and a or 2 years. But I learnt my Tokples mainly through immersion because I had to communicate with my cousins and everyone else around me. And I spent my days following my grandma and all of her friends. And I was surrounded by these women who completely enveloped me in love. And I think that was the greatest grounding to my adult life, really. One of the ladies who raised me or helped raise me died recently. But throughout my life, after I left the village, went to school, went to university, all of that, my parents would go back and visit her. And her first question was to ask how I was doing and where I was and, you know, how I was going in life. And these are people who really did not have a Western education in the conventional sense, but they lived these incredible lives. And part of, as cliche as it may sound, part of this sort of ancient Stone Age culture that has really disappeared largely. And it was fast disappearing when I was running around in my yellow gumboots, following them everywhere. So it was a great time. And I learned to speak my Tokples, and I'm still fluent in Tokples today, which is wonderful. And I saw and understood things about our culture that I think not a lot of people in my era had that opportunity to do. And I spoke to my parents recently, and we sort of, you know, as adults, we retroactively performance manage our parents. And I said to them, you know, you guys have been relatively good parents, but I think the greatest gift you gave me was to take me back to the village. And I'm still very thankful for that. So however many years on, that's probably had the greatest impact on my childhood.
Oh, that's incredible. What an absolute privilege to be able to have that opportunity, but also being able to have access to that. And I think a lot of us do take that for granted, this idea of like going back to the village and being surrounded by our aunties and our bubus. And I think those are, yeah, those I think you're absolutely right. It is the greatest gift our parents can give us. What did that experience teach you about this sense of belonging?
So it taught me just how much we are supported by our communities, by the fact that I bristle when non-Papua New Guineans try to talk about socialism, because I think we were inherently socialist. We shared everything right down to the children that we have, you know, and I was raised by a community. People loved and cared for me. I would go to one Wubu's house and stay with her for a couple of days. And my parents didn't really worry where I was because they knew that I was being cared for by someone within the community. And I think we, you know, it gives us this enormous gift. And I think it's a superpower that we Papua New Guineans have because we go out into the world with people behind us who may not be technically our blood, right? But these are members of a community that we are part of and we belong to them. And that sense of belonging is a deeply grounding thing.
Absolutely. You mentioned your talk best before, and we obviously get a sense of how important that is to you. How has speaking your talk bless shaped the way you carry culture, even while living in so-called Australia?
I think it's shaped the way I can relate to people. So, for example, you know, whenever I go home and I'm conversing with a bubu or an auntie or whoever, there are certain things that we talk about and describe and articulate in talk bless that English can't really cover. And for me, it's a commonality that you share with your people. And again, the other thing that sort of causes me great distress in some instances is the fact that that's being lost as well. Like I'll have conversations and, you know, I speak my father's talk bless, which is, what people would consider a difficult talk bless to speak, but I think it's magnificent. And there are conversations that I have with my dad where we will lapse from English into talk bless and we completely understand each other. But, what we're talking about, you can't, you know, translate it word for word into English, but it's a far more nuanced description or a far more nuanced figure of speech, for example. So I think speaking our talk bless, we explain it away by saying, oh, it's a great, you know, part of your identity as Papua New Guineans, and it is, but I think it's far broader than that. It really connects you to your people beyond time and place in a lot of ways. You know, when I go home, I may have been away from my home for years or whatever, but if I speak talk bless, that takes me right back to my childhood and to communicating with people like my grandparents on a level that I don't think English and talk bless can really reach.
How do you hold both the village, in particular your culture, and also whilst navigating a contemporary world, so living in Sydney, living on Gadigal, how do you hold both of them in your sense of self? How do you juggle that, I guess?
Oh, Wendy, asking the hard questions. well, you know, I think it's very easy to, because I think we're constantly reminded in our interactions with other people, especially in Australia, especially in Gadigal, where I find when I'm interacting with non-Papua New Guineans, for example, and upon first meeting you, people try to place you and they immediately they ask you questions about, oh, how you ended up coming to Australia, how you live here, what you do here, all of these sorts of things. And you internally have to have a conversation with yourself, I think, as to which parts of your upbringing that come to the fore when you have those conversations with other people. And I quite often think to myself, number one, I identify as being a member of my father's tribe first and foremost, but I understand that that means very little in the Western context that I live in at the moment. I think our communities carry us far beyond what we think they do all the time. Subconsciously, I think that that's always there for me. And I've been thinking a lot about how whenever I speak to someone, when they try to place me, it's very difficult for me to explain to them that I'm a little bit more than what you may think I am when you speak to me. You know, you immediately look at me as, okay, I work as a lawyer. That's my number one identifying factor. But I'm also a member of my community. I'm also a daughter of a Western Highlands man, and I identify with his tribe and all of these sorts of things. And I, the longer I live away from that, I do worry sometimes that I'm losing that connection.
Who were the women who helped raise you in the village and beyond?
So first of all, my village name, I'm named after my father's great aunt, and she was my great grandfather's firstborn daughter. And from there, my father always tells me that his aunties were incredible and incredible women who, as much as they lived in a sort of a Stone Age life. And then I have, you know, a raft of cousins and all of that who are all wonderful women and incredibly high achievers, etc. But when I look at the women in the village, you know, my grandmother's friends, they taught me so much about little things like how important it is to go out into the sunlight, for example, or how important it was to share things that you had, or to share your life with your family and friends. But the women that raised me the most in the village were my maternal grandmother, who is still alive, who's still with us, and who is incredible. And all of her friends. And these were, you know, married to traditional men. Some of them were polygamous. And that whole sort of, even as a child, understanding how they navigated their spaces within their communities was an incredible experience for me. You know, at that age, you didn't have the tools to understand it. But as I've gotten older, I've realized just how much agency, for lack of a better term, those women held, and how complex it is to be a woman who's married into a particular village or a community, and to really navigate your place in that area.
How have those lessons and those teachings from those women that taught you, raised you, left imprints on you, how have those lessons shown up in the way you carry yourself now, especially in your legal career, I guess, as a lawyer?
I think it's made me critical of schools of thought, especially if we try to sort of look at things in a more philosophical level, you know, where we expect that with more exposure, more progress, post-colonization, et cetera, we would take on more Western ways of conducting ourselves. And I think it's important for us to stop and think that maybe our ancestors, they knew what they were doing. They've been they've been around for quite some time.
They might have some ideas,
yeah. You know? Mm. And I remember, like, when I was little, my grandmother would always plant peanuts after she'd planted cacao or corn or whatever. Every time they turned the crop over, they would plant peanuts. And I just took it as that was normal. And my grandma explained it to me that we do that every single time we change the crops. I get to year 8 science, and I was taught that you plant legumes in order to, I think, put nitrogen back in the soil or something like that. And so I had this conversation with my dad about it. My dad was like, we've been doing that for thousands of years, you know? And modern science is telling you that that's the benefit of it. But I think there's so much wisdom in how our people have lived that it is a great loss to us if we don't pay attention to that. And that's probably where my sort of train of thought has been. I'm critical of what, you know, the Western world tries to tell us how we should live our lives. I know the ironies. I'm sitting here, you know, in the middle of sort of corporate Sydney talking about this, but the fact that our people had been living these ways for thousands of years, they understood how to self-regulate, you know, and all of those sorts of things that we talk about now, all these buzzwords that we talk about now in the modern world of social media. But if you really sit down and think about it, I think they had some ideas, they had some ways of doing things, and how they navigated their lives amongst each other for however long.
You're listening to Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Wendy Mockey, and I'm speaking with Elvina O'Gill. Now, Elvina, you work as a commercial and corporate lawyer in Sydney, but beyond those spaces, you use your voice in writing, in public forums, and through your podcasts to challenge the structures that often go unnamed, from gendered inequality to colonial legacies. You name what many people would rather ignore. When did you first begin to recognize the role that inherited systems play in shaping everyday life in Papua New Guinea?
So I went back to Papua New Guinea in about 2014 to live and work, 2014, 2013. And I lived and worked there for three and a half years. And while I was there, I was fortunate enough to work for a multinational. But I think that gave me the greatest exposure to understanding how inherited systems operate, sometimes as an impediment to the development and the progress of people in Papua New Guinea, particularly women. One of them is the dual wage system. And I think I've had some conversations about that while I was working in Papua New Guinea, after I'd left Papua New Guinea, and also after having conversations with Papua New Guineans that I worked with, and understanding just how significant the difference was between even just basic issues of between Papua New Guineans and non-Papua New Guinean staff that worked at this particular multinational that I worked at. And the significant difference in remuneration, which did not appear to be fair, equitable, and reflective of what what qualifications those particular Papua New Guineans had. But I also knew that I spoke from the benefit of and the privilege of someone who could see it from the outside and could say something about it with you know, a lot less fear of perhaps any repercussions that would come to me. But I spoke about it extensively because I couldn't abide it. You know, there were some situations where I thought we can pay lip service to conversations around modern slavery and things like that, or how much we would like, you know, the progress of women economically in Papua New Guinea. But I think we fail to acknowledge that women can't really progress if they're not making economic progress in their financial circumstances. And that's how best a family can progress socioeconomically, right? So one of the key things that I noticed when I lived and worked in Papua New Guinea was that significant gap between how Papua New Guineans are remunerated and how non-Papua New Guineans are remunerated. And just also how those systems are so strongly entrenched in Papua New Guinea that it is going to take perhaps a generation before we start seeing some change. I think it's too long to wait for that to happen. I think we should be talking about this over and over. And I know that conversations have been had on the floor of parliament, but I think these things do require legislative change, for example, to hold these large corporations to account as to how they pay the people in the countries that they operate, such as Papua New Guinea.
And how do you think those legal and cultural systems shape the way people see their own potential?
I can honestly say I think it is extremely demoralizing for younger Papua New Guineans who, you know, I think a lot of Papua New Guineans who are educated overseas, for example, like myself, we have these sorts of noble aspirations of going back and contributing to our country. And some Papua New Guineans do that. And I think when you go back to your home country and you realize how poorly you're compensated for your education, for your qualifications, etc., it takes away from perhaps what you'd had in mind as to how you wanted to contribute to your country. I couldn't think of anything more demoralizing than getting paid far less than someone who is, you know, really far less qualified than I am. I couldn't think of anything worse. You spend your 4 or 5 years of your life going to university only to, you know, to work and be paid so little that you can't afford rent. And that's the reality for Papua New Guineans, young Papua New Guineans working in Port Moresby. I couldn't think of anything worse. And, you know, I bristled against that system for a long time. And I think we need to keep talking about it because it continues to this day. There are young Papua New Guineans who are struggling to feed their families, who struggle to pay. And, you know, we talk about the fact that a lot of Papua New Guineans, unfortunately, have to live intergenerationally in their, you know, family home for however long they get married or they have children and they return to the home that they shared with their parents purely because they can't afford to move out. And these are Papua New Guineans who are highly qualified in the work that they do. And they're just not paid well enough. That's the entire crux of the matter. So, and these are systems that have been in place for decades now. And, you know, I think they started pre-colonial times and they've continued and we haven't re-examined it to catch up to the modern economy and to the way the world has gone. So it's an important conversation. I hope we continue.
Speaking of conversations, your podcast, Who Asked Her?, is recognized as Papua New Guinea's first feminist podcast. What inspired you to create this platform and what conversations were you aiming to ignite within your community?
I think really because something, you know what I mean? Sorry, just lapse into talk in Papua New Guinea, conversations take the forefront in a lot of things. And so I would have these great conversations with my girlfriends. And so the idea just came to me, condense those into a podcast and talk about topical things, talk about things that that we think that Papua New Guineans would like to hear about, or not just Papua New Guineans, but people in the Pacific, because I think we had a bit of a broader listenership around the Pacific. But there were certain things that we addressed that I think are really probably deeper topics. Like we talked about, so when I got my tattoos done, we talked about that whole process, I think, prior to independence for a lot of countries across the Pacific, where missionaries came in and decreed that the process of traditional tattooing was considered unacceptable, and they put a stop to it. And the Melanesian Marts, the people who completed my tattoos, highlighted to me that there are women in Papua New Guinea. I think there's one woman who's, I think she's possibly in her 80s now, but half her body is tattooed and the other half wasn't, because while they were going through the process of marking her traditionally, missionaries came in and put a stop to it. And she is, I think she's, her body is really a piece of history in the sense that it shows us how missionaries came and decreed to us that a lot of our traditional practices were pagan or were unacceptable or were unchristian, etc. And I think that was a really, that was an excellent conversation. So we recorded that episode while she was giving me my tattoos. And Melanesian Marks has gone on and led this resurgence of traditional tattooing across the Pacific, which we've talked about other things too, like cultural appropriation and the theft of cultural artifact by not Papua New Guineans, particularly non-Papua New Guinean women, and selling them off. And that, you know, that's, I think, was centered around the Bilum and its integrity as a cultural artifact in PNG and things like that. So we had some excellent conversations, and some of the episodes were really out of things that I would see on social media or I would see happening in Papua New Guinea and perhaps disagree with how they were being done. But overall, I think it's really about letting us talk about ourselves, determining how we interact with the outside world, but also how we interact with each other and having these conversations ourselves, because I think they've been driven so much by outsiders who try to drive the agenda and how Papua New Guinean women interact with each other. And so, I mean, now podcasts are ubiquitous. They're everywhere. Everyone has a mic and records one. But I think it's really important that we have more podcasts coming out of Papua New Guinea. And I've seen that Papua New Guineans have really taken to that space of talking, particularly Papua New Guinean men. And so I really hope there are more Papua New Guinean women that start having podcasts and start talking, because the dude bro space is really quite full.
In a society where feminism is often considered taboo, launching such a podcast is a bold move. Now, how was their response from listeners in PNG and the diaspora, and what impact do you hope it continues to have?
Initially, the response was overwhelming, to be quite honest. A lot of younger Papua New Guineans would reach out to me and say that they really identified with some of the things we talked about. I think some of these, you know, we try to make the topics as varied as possible. And I hope to restart the podcast this year sometime and continue the conversations that we started back then. But the response was incredible from Papua New Guineans. And I was greatly appreciative that so many Papua New Guineans listened in, shared with me ideas about what to talk about, what they would like to talk about. And interestingly, overwhelmingly, a lot of Papua New Guinean women wanted to talk about the expat Papua New Guinean pay gap. Many, many women reached out to me to talk about that. And I think it's worth having more conversations around that.
I'm wondering, what makes you keep speaking when the topics are difficult or uncomfortable?
It's not for the fun of it sometimes, because I think that a lot of times it can become a bit of a draining conversation to have. But I think people like myself, if you have a little bit of a platform, it's wise to talk about these things, and also to reflect other people's life experiences that aren't specifically your own. So in the conversation around the wage duality, for example, that doesn't technically affect me anymore. I live and work in Australia, so that's not an issue for me. But it's something that I think, you know, I would love to speak about for other Papua New Guineans who may not be able to, for fear of you know, repercussions to themselves. So there are issues, I think, that I would talk about, but I'm also cautious as to how those issues are viewed, particularly if I am speaking about it from where I am currently in Australia. But that particular one, I think, is something that, unfortunately, you know, people are going to hear from me on for a while yet, because I think it's completely unfair, it's inequitable, and premised on really systems of racism that existed in PNG for quite some time.
Across your work, from law to writing to podcasting, you've made space for honesty, for difficult conversations, and for reimagining what justice and accountability could look like. You stand firmly in both cultural grounding and professional clarity. And in doing so, shift how Papua New Guinean women are seen and heard. What do you hope younger Papua New Guineans carry forward from your generation?
I think one of the things that I really hope that, you know, living and working in Australia as a commercial lawyer leads to perhaps a reimagining of what Papua New Guinean women are capable of. I hope that that is not just how we view ourselves, but how non-Papua New Guineans that we interact with in our home, in our countries that are not our home countries view us as. I've encountered situations where quite often I'm the only woman in a meeting, or I'm the only brown person in a meeting. And I think that what I hope that younger Papua New Guineans take from that is that if you find yourself at that table or in that situation, you deserve to be there. And that's exactly what, you know, that I hope living and working in and building my career in Australia is, you know, is a key part of imparting that particular knowledge, because it can be intimidating. It can be difficult to make that step into corporate Australia, for example. But if you're at that table, then I think, you know, it's important to remind yourself you deserve to be there.
In light of Papua New Guinea heading towards our 50 years of independence, what principles from PNG's early nationhood do you think are worth returning to?
I think we should all read the national goals and directives. That is the preamble to our constitution. When I lived in PNG, it was part of seeking to get admitted to the bar in Papua New Guinea to undertake constitutional law. And I read our constitution, and I will admit that I wept through the whole thing, because it is an incredible document, probably the most beautiful document I've ever read. It is aspirational. It's noble. It's all of those things that we as Papua New Guineans should see ourselves as in the next 50 years or so. And I think Sir John Momus reached out recently and spoke about how we've lost focus on human development as a key part of that particular, national goal and directive. But I think all Papua New Guineans should read that. Even if you don't have an interest in the constitution itself, at least read those principles, because they're incredible. I learned then too that, you know, prior to independence, the Constitutional Planning Committee walked the length and breadth of the country and consulted with the people and basically said to our people, you know, we are here to create this new country and this new document that's going to underpin how we move forward as a country. How do you see yourselves? And I think that's an incredibly noble thing that they did. And they spoke to the ordinary Papua New Guinean, and they took from them what each Papua New Guinean articulated and what they wanted to see in their new country. So I think on 50 years of independence, a revisiting of those particular national goals would be a great place to start.
And finally, what's one thing about your culture or community that isn't widely known or celebrated, but you wish the world understood?
Oh, my goodness. That we invented socialism before everyone else understood it.
Period.
Yes. And I mean that in a sense, not in the sort of the political, the more esoteric sense, but in the sense that we invented safety nets and caring for each other before it became a thing in the rest of the world. These are things we were inherently raised with, to care for your brother, to care for your sister, even if they weren't your actual brother or sister. Those are the things I think we don't understand about, or other people don't understand about us.
Elvina, you don't move through the world quietly. You move with the fire and wisdom of the women who came before you. You see the system, where it came from, who it was built for, and you call it what it is. Because silence has never protected people like us. You bring intellect, yes, but also clarity and a deep refusal to pretend not to see what's broken. You honour where you come from without softening who you've become. You remind us that nationhood wasn't shaped solely in parliament halls. It was built within language, in villages, in the quiet leadership of women who never made the headlines but made everything possible. Thank you for showing up without compromise, for standing firm in truth, even when it's inconvenient, even when it's uncomfortable, and for reminding us that sometimes telling the truth is the most loving thing you can do for your people. You've been listening to Stories from the Pacific, presented by me, Wendy Mockey, and produced by Jaden Mailata. If you like this episode and want more,
Be sure to listen to other episodes in our program by searching up Stories from the Pacific on our website or wherever you get your podcasts. This story was produced on the lands of the Yuggera and Turrbal people.
What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is it hard to get medicine you need in the Pacific?
It came to a point where he was admitted where he got blood poisoning. He needed antibiotics for that, and that was not available.
Join me, Scott Whitehair, on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favorite podcast app to listen.